This is part three of Work, Rest, and Play. The recession has hit us hard. We've lost one of our stools. We're just hoping that he finds Jesus and returns to us soon. Speaking of Jesus, I always find it interesting the sort of things that people talk to Jesus about, and how, if we're really honest, the things that people talk to Jesus about is probably not the type of things that we would like to think that people spoke to Jesus about. So, like, perhaps an exercise for you, if you had a chance to ask Jesus a question, what would you ask him? Would you have a question? Maybe there's something that comes immediately to mind and you think, if I was gonna ask Jesus a question, I know what I would ask him. I would ask this or that or the next thing. Or perhaps you're the type of person who would think, oh my goodness, that's gonna take some time. Let me think about that. Of course, Jesus is a real person, and Jesus walks around in first century Palestine and is asked real questions. So here we have the Messiah, the savior of the world, the one who is bringing hope to all people. And people ask him questions like this. Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. Profound. Like, you get a chance to talk to Jesus, and the question you come up with is, can you sort out the argument I'm having with my brother about who gets what of the money? Like, you'd like to think that guy somewhere is like, oh my goodness, and they wrote that question down. There's a group of people somewhere in history that go, and it was him. I was there that day when that guy asked Jesus. He got a chance to ask Jesus a question, and the best thing he could come up with was, hey, like, divide my dad's will. Jesus replies to the man in Mark chapter 12. He says, man, like, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? And then he says to them, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. In the ancient mind, the word greed, it literally means of having much and wanting it, sort of thing. So that sense of Jesus is saying, hey, just be careful. Because let's be honest, like, the word greed kind of reacts in us a little bit. Like, you know, you ask somebody, hey, are you greedy? And like, very, very rarely do people want to go, yes, yes, totally. It's my life goal, in fact. And you've just help me understand that that's what I've always been living for. But the word greed literally translates the notion which is of wanting and having much. Now that becomes a little more uncomfortable, doesn't it? Jesus says, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of wanting more. Life, Jesus says, life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. Jesus says, you gotta be careful because you might find yourself wanting all sorts of things, and these things will kind of chase you down, and they sneak in on you, and nobody answers the question, hey, you know, like, I'm really greedy. But if the question was, do you ever find yourself wanting more than you have? Let's just move on beyond that. Jesus, however, says life is more than that. Life actually doesn't consist of this. All of these things that we so easily get dragged towards, we so uncomfortably shift in our chairs when the question is asked, would you ever want anything more? Or have you ever purchased something that you didn't really need? Have you ever bought something before the previous something had ceased to be useful? In Jesus' time, people sometimes did that. And yet Jesus says, actually, life isn't about that. Life consists, or rather, it does not consist in an abundance of possessions. It does. Life is not about having more. Well, that's helpful, Jesus. And so he tells them a parable, which, if you remember, when we've talked about parables here at Westside before, and if you weren't here, then let me just remind you, when Jesus starts telling a parable, run for your life. Because it's going to sound like a neat little story that people are going to recite for thousands of years and feel warm and kind of cuddly about themselves. But actually, beneath that story is a trap. Parables are always kind of set up to say, hey, we're going to talk about this little thing, but it's going to get really uncomfortable really quickly. And Jesus tells these people a parable. The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. So he thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. So, brief intersection on the parable there for a second. Nobody that Jesus is speaking to can relate to this. We kind of assume that really good storytelling involves telling stories that people go, man, this is a great story. I'm really getting where he's going with this story, and I'm relating to it. But in Jesus' time, this was an agrarian first century society where very few people lived far beyond subsistence. So very, very few people in Jesus' culture and time are really aware of where their food's coming from tomorrow. Right? Most of them are basically hoping that they can stay well enough and fit enough today in order to be able to eat for today. They're at the hands of the gods, literally, in terms of what might happen to their crops or their health or their ability to earn money. So when you find ancient people talking about being wealthy, oftentimes they're actually just talking about being a few sort of, you know, days down the line. Like in a lot of social scientists tell us that in the first century, if you kind of knew where your food was coming for the next couple of days, like you were beginning to move yourself up into the upper echelons of society. The vast majority of people didn't know how today was going to go, and they might not even have enough to do it. So Jesus starts a story about a man who has so much crop that he doesn't know what to do with it. This would be like Jeff Bezos coming here right now and telling us how difficult his life is. And we would be kind of like, exactly like that. Like, yeah, okay, whatever. Get a real job. Pay your workers properly. No, anyway. So Jesus starts with a story that actually people would struggle to relate to, because I've never been in a situation that I've had so much that I don't know what to do with it. So the story continues. Then he, this is the man, says to himself, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. So again, Jesus starts to play with you a little bit here in this storytelling. Now, Jesus' parables are told in a context, in a place, in a time that has history, that has political goings on, that has theology, that has worldview, that has philosophy. All of these things are happening. As much as they're happening now, they're happening in Jesus' time. And when Jesus says a phrase like this, to us it just sounds like a logical part of the story. The guy's got too much stuff, so he's going to build bigger places to put his extra stuff. But Jesus is kind of codifying his language here a little bit, I think. I think he's doing something that's sort of kind of trying to point something out to you that if you're really sharp, you'll pick up on. Now, I think, let me put it like this way. You know how we can talk in culture, and we do this with humor quite a lot, where actually most of the things that we do in terms of humor are related to stuff that's going on in the world that's around us. And the reason that we're able to laugh about particular things is because nobody's really saying what they're saying, but we all know what they're saying, right? And so you see this with political commentary quite a lot. Jesus is doing things in this parable here where he's saying things, and if we're 2,000 years ago, we might not hear all the things that he's saying. So imagine if I was to start a story today and said, once upon a time there was a ruler, he used to be a drama teacher, and then he was in charge. Or there once was a powerful man that had a big button and his skin was orange. So this is exactly how it works. Like, so I've not explained what I'm talking about. They're going to listen to this sermon. They're not going to listen to this sermon in 10 years' time. But if they did, it might not make a lot of sense, because you remove yourself from the context and you miss what's going on. When Jesus says a man built barns because he had too much stuff, in a first century Jewish context, I think it'd be hard not to think back to the story of Joseph. Joseph found himself in Egypt as a prisoner, and through this sort of hand of God, he found himself in the end being in charge of a huge period of growth in Egypt's history, where they had an abundance of everything. But Joseph also knew that a day was coming when the abundance was going to run out. So what did Joseph do? He built storehouses, he built barns, he built large places for Egypt to treasure up all of the excess that they had. Well, that just sounds like it makes good sense, you might say. Except that in the biblical story, this is an important point of what's going on, because once Egypt have stored up all of this stuff, eventually the young, small, just beginning to form people of Israel find themselves running out of food. And what do the people of Israel do? They come to Egypt, to these barns, and they ask if they can have from this barn. They are able to take from all of the abundance of Egypt, but what does it cost them? Well, this is where the story starts in the famous Prince of Egypt by Disney, but it's also in the Bible. This is where the story starts, that the Israelites sell themselves into slavery so that they can live off the abundance of Egypt. So I think it's hard if you're a Jewish person listening to Jesus' story here to hear about barns and bigger barns and the growing of barns and not realize that this is a way of life that ultimately leads to slavery. This is a way of life that will take you down a particular trajectory. It will take you to a particular place, and it will cost you everything. And bearing in mind the end result of the story of Egypt is the Pharaoh who builds the barns loses his own son and a lot of his kingdom in that process. So Jesus codifies a little warning right there in the early part of this story to say, hey, do you know what? This story's not a good story. If you're listening to this as a first century Jewish person, you're going, okay, this is a horror story we're part of here. This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. The man continues, and I'll say to my life, this is a literal sort of reading of the text here. Often it's translated, and I'll say to myself, or he said to himself, or something like that. But it literally reads, and I'll say to my life. The Greek word is the word psuche, which I know you love a new Greek word. You know the word psuche. We use it all the time in contemporary life because it's from the Greek notion of psuche that we get the word psychology. The psyche, the sense of what's going on, the sort of connectedness of our whole lives. So the man sort of is saying to himself, but his whole being, I'll say to my life, life, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Rest, eat, drink, be merry. Living the dream. He's done well for himself. He's happy with himself. He's got himself to a particular place, and it looks like everything's working well for him. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? See, because there's more to life, remember what Jesus said, than just an abundance of possessions. In fact, you can have the storehouses and the barns and all of the treasures. You can gather it all together, but there's more to life than that. And that life ends up being asked of this man, and what then happens with everything he's stored up. And then Jesus adds his own commentary to his parable, which is rare. Jesus doesn't always do this, but he adds this commentary and says this, this is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves but is not rich towards God. Again, it's a little bit of language for you if you're okay with it. When he says whoever stores up, the word that Jesus kind of uses there, I wanted to translate this word barns up, but apparently that's not an English verb. But essentially, whoever storehouses, whoever barns up, whoever treasures up things for themselves, but is not rich towards God. And Jesus unpacks this further. He says to his disciples, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, your psuche. Don't worry about what you'll eat or about your body, what you will wear. For life is more than food and the body more than clothes. So 2,000 years ago, Jesus tells a parable to a group of agrarian farmers in first century Palestine, but the language that he uses speaks to us, I think, like 21 centuries later. That is it possible that we as humans might easily forget that life is more than what we have? That life is more than what we can possess, that life is more than what we can own. But our attempt is so often to store up everything that we own, to gather it all together, because if I can just make sure that I've got it all together, if I can work in such a way that I can have all of this surplus, then everything will be okay for me. But Jesus wants to reprogram and rehabituate his disciples slightly by suggesting that what if it's possible to do all of those things and discover that life is more than that? And no matter how much you save, no matter how much you store up, no matter how much you barn up or treasure, it's the wrong thing. Okay, so in 1930, moving it forward fast, John Maynard Keynes predicted in an essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, he predicted that life was moving at such a pace and technology was becoming so advanced that by the 21st century, most people wouldn't need to work more than 15 hours a week in order to earn all that they needed to live and be content. How's that working out for us? 15-hour week. Maynard Keynes believed that such was the sort of requirements of the human that he couldn't imagine that by the 21st century, we wouldn't have figured it out, that we would literally do the 15 hours work we needed to live happily, and then we would move on. He continues in this essay to then say, get this for a piece of prophecy, for the first time since his creation, man will be faced with his real, his permanent problem, how to occupy the leisure. And I know that many of you have, you know, found yourself this week sat thinking to yourself, what can I do with all my free time? So much leisure. You know, I mean, I meet people regularly out in the mountains and they're going, well, there's just so much free time. I wish there was time to go to the office. You know, so I'm going to just put it out there controversially that Maynard Keynes was wrong and that he badly predicted the future. What he was doing, it seems, was he was looking at the way things were in the 1930s and looking at the progression of technology and thinking in order for us to live as we live right now, in the future, it will surely only take us 15 hours in order to gain the amount of finance that we need to live as we do in the 1930s. What he wasn't apparently gambling on was humans. And as we about developed more and more capacity to make more money, guess what? We just wanted more money. The ability for us to want to build barns and to build storehouses and to treasure things up is way beyond what we've been able to predict in the past. And as humans get busier and busier and busier and more skilled and more able to produce things, what happens is we just want more things. And Jesus said, there's more to life than just an abundance of possessions. It's fascinating that the 21st century is the first time in the last 2,000 years that we have records for anyway, wherein the richest people of society have longer working weeks than the poorest. Generally, what we've seen throughout history, and I don't really want to jump into a discussion about how we quantify rich and poor, but just simply looking at this, if you actually track the amount of time that people spend at their job doing their job, in the 21st century, for the first time in trackable world history, it's the highest earners of society that spend the most time in their workplace. So Maynard was unbelievably wrong at some level. As he predicted economic development, he thought this will mean that the richer you are, the less time you spend working. But something changed around about the 1980s and 1990s. They're able to track this change that the richest 10% of people now have longer working weeks than anybody else. Something's gone a little wrong in terms of what we thought we would do with our lives. And the big question, how are we going to occupy our leisure? Of course, John Maynard Keynes was also writing in the 1930s, and he was unaware that coming sometime after this was Netflix. And now we're always got something to do with our leisure time. In fact, it's quite interesting to watch how these things sort of grow, that we now have streaming service upon streaming service upon streaming service. Do you remember when you just were able to like have one streaming service and it was Netflix and it was free because you stole the password from your friend and there are many people, you log into anyone, you go to anybody's house, they switch on their Netflix, there's like 17 options of people that could potentially watch it, because to my understanding, there's only 3 people in the world actually pay for Netflix, and the rest of us borrow it from somebody that we used to know. But now we've got all these streaming services, and it's becoming much harder to keep track of who actually pays for it and who's got the passwords and all these sorts of things. And they're constantly adding new content to it. I just saw this particular week that they're bringing out another get together for Friends. Those of us that grew up in the 90s, like Friends is coming back. Me Too happened, fortunately, and yet we're going to release more Joey Tribbiani onto the screen. I don't really figure out how that works, but. But all of these shows and all of these content that are constantly coming into our life to say, here's something you could do with your leisure time. You could just watch this and you could just, just consume and binge. There's a word, isn't it? Binge. Binge used to be a negative word, right? Somebody would say, oh, they're binge drinking or they're binge eating. Or a binge was always a sort of kind of negative term. But now we have this new sort of vocab where we talk about binge watching. What are you going to do this weekend? I'm binge watch season 3. And I'm going to binge watch that. And it's become this kind of beautiful space where we can basically not care about personal hygiene and just sit in front of the television all day and just consume whatever it says. The new season drops at 8 p.m. and I'll be here till 3 a.m. when it's finished. And life will be good again. Have you noticed how to actually not binge contemporary television, you have to be proactive? If you're passive, it just keeps showing you things. You know, so you get to the end of the TV show and it goes, episode 3 is starting in 15, 14, 13. For those of us that grew up in the NASA era, it's super exciting. It's like 10, 9, 8, 7. Oh my goodness, something exciting is going to happen. And then it jumps on and it starts to show it to you. And I noticed just recently that a lot of the shows I watch have stopped doing that thing that used to happen with shows I watched when I was younger, right? So shows I watched when I was younger, this is how they went. The commercials would finish and you would start watching the show, and the show would begin with previously on. Remember that? Previously on. And then, if I said what it was previously on, you would know the kind of terrible television I watched. So I'll keep that just between me and Jesus. Previous, it's not there anymore, because I think Netflix are like, yeah, who are you kidding? You watched the last episode 15 seconds ago. You don't need a catch up now. You can just, you know exactly where this is going. And then there's that thing, like, and you know this, like this horrible moment you have where Netflix does this thing where after several shows, it then pauses briefly and it says, are you still watching? Like, talk about shame. Like when they binge watching design TV app says to you, most people have given up by now. our algorithm tells us that you should be asleep in bed or doing something else right now. So we're just gonna quickly check in. The computer is saying, I think you've gone too far, And you click okay, and you realize that you get cramp in your thumb because that's the only movement you've made in the last 4 hours, other than to stop the TV going into automatic standby because it too thinks that nobody should have done nothing for this amount of time. We become bingers, and therefore we become consumers. And one of the problems with being a consumer is what it does to our brains. Neil Postman in the 1980s wrote a book which is increasingly seen as a piece of cultural prophecy. Postman wrote a book called Entertaining Ourselves to Death. Postman wrote this book because he was a little bit worried. He was American, I want to say Postman was a philosopher, but he had a kind of prophetic edge to him, I think. But Postman was concerned in the 1980s because the Americans had just employed an actor into the role of president. And this was shocking as far as Postman was concerned, because he was like, when we end up in a culture where our TV stars are now the rulers of our country, something very strange has happened. So he said, what's happened is our entertainment culture has sort of taken over, and people are now no longer thinking in terms of people's ability. They're just thinking in terms of their sort of familiarity, that we like the look of these particular people. So Postman's writing in a Reagan era, and he's talking often about television. He isn't talking about the upcoming computers, internet, and social media. And I'd love to know what he thought about all of that. But Postman says, here's the problem what happens when you sit down in front of a screen. Something goes on in your mind where you essentially start to lose your critical faculties. You stop critiquing. You start just consuming. So Postman says, if you're over here critiquing, perhaps you're reading a novel, right? Or you're reading a piece of literature, you're reading a book of some sort, or maybe you're even just at a play, maybe you went to the theater. Something's going on in your brain while you're there. You're taking in the words, you're thinking about what's happening, and you're critiquing it. What do I think about this? Am I happy with what's going on? Do I like what's being said here? Do I agree with the worldview of this particular thing that I'm engaging with? But yet when we're over here just watching television, or on social media, I think, or just in front of our computer screen, something changes in us. Let me ask you the question like this. Think about something that you've watched in the last week and this is not any kind of sin and repentance moment, right? Okay, but just don't shout it out. But think about something you've watched in the last week. If you were watching that exact TV show at the theater, how comfortable would you be with that? Or if you were reading it in a book, if they were describing the sex scene or the violence or the abuse that was happening and your critical faculties were switched on, how comfortable would you be with it? If you had to watch real people on a stage do the things that you watched on your TV screen, simply the question is, would you be okay with that? And then your answer to that question, and this is the thing I find myself asking also when I think about Postman's critique of us, is that the truth is for many of us, like, can you imagine going to see Game of Thrones, the real life edition? You know, think how long the intervals would be just so they could mop up blood. You know, and yet we watch this quite uncritically on our television shows. And this is not me doing that kind of pastoral thing where I'm now going to suggest only watch shows made by Focus on the Family. That's really, really not what I'm saying. But it strikes me that Postman makes a point that 30 years, 40 years later is still valid, that something switches off in our minds when we start consuming rather than critiquing. So what should we do with our leisure time? Well, just whatever it tells me to do. And this starts to shape me and form me in ways that I just wonder if it's worth us asking, is this the use of our leisure time that we're actually comfortable with? Are we happy with the sort of things we're consuming? Or do we need to kind of power up a few extra processors in our brain that have previously gone to sleep and say, what sort of worldviews am I being exposed to here? What ideas, what notions are coming my way? Why does this matter? Well, see, Jesus tells a story about a man who stored up barns, and he calls all these barns together, and then God comes to him and says, well, life is a heck of a lot more than that, because when you lose your life, what are you going to do with all that stuff? And Jesus then continues to talk about worry, and he talks about how we might worry about things unless we start to trust in God. And then a few verses later on in this passage, he then says this. In Luke chapter 12 and verse 34, he says, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The word that Jesus uses for treasure here is the same word he used earlier on for storehouse. So Jesus says, where you barn stuff, that's where your heart is. Where you put stuff, where you invest stuff. Now, we naturally start to hear, and I think it's a kind of human condition, we naturally start to hear a story like this and we start to think economically, right? We start to think about where's your money going, or what are you investing your finance into? But just try and think a little more broadly for a moment. What about your time? What about your thoughts? What about your mental energies? What about the philosophies, your worldview? What about all of those sort of things? Where are you placing them? Where are they going? What do you spend your time thinking about? What do you spend your time pondering? Is it something that you critique, like Postman tells us we should? Are you watching television shows, and are you reading books, and are you engaging with conversations, and you're thinking about like how this is forming me and what this is doing to me? When was the last time you stopped watching a movie? When was the last time you got to a point in reading a book or watching a TV show or engaging in something that you thought, do you know what? I don't like what this is doing to me. Might sound like a selfish question, but maybe it's a preservation question, or maybe it's just the discipleship question that actually, unless I start switching on my critical factories, maybe I'm faculties and factories, let's go with both. maybe you got to build it somewhere, so a factory will do. Maybe I need to switch on my critical faculties and be aware of the fact that actually this thing that I'm watching, maybe I've just watched too much of it, or maybe I don't like what it's asking of me, or maybe I don't like what it's forcing on me. Because if Jesus is right, and let's just go with an idea that he is, let's just think that maybe where I'm investing my time, what I'm opening my eyes to, what I'm allowing to shape me, maybe that's shaping my heart. Maybe it's changing who I am. See, because what we often want to believe is that our identity is greater than our behavior. So we have our identity, and this is who we are. And the Bible talks to us a lot about identity. And this is why I think it's really important for us to think seriously about our theology of work and our theology of rest and our theologies of pray, because what's coming out of those things is often a question of our identity. We talked last week about how if God forms us and makes us before he asks us to do anything, then there's an intrinsic anthropological statement in Scripture which says you have value before you do anything. So the Bible always works from a place of identity to behavior. Who you are informs what you do. But when we sit down in front of, you know, anything, and I don't, it's easy to pick on Netflix, I mean, or just be clever and talk about Amazon Prime instead, but, you know, I mean everything that we expose ourselves to. What we also know happens is, whereas the Bible forms us in this way and says, where your treasure is, there is your heart, we also know that if we're not careful, what we do starts to eventually form our identity. what we expose ourselves to uncritically, what we just simply, if we just kind of take in whatever the world throws our way without thinking about it, is there a point wherein this equation gets reversed and all of a sudden now our behavior starts to define who we are? Is it possible that we, as Jesus followers, need to look at how we work, how we rest, how we play, and ask ourselves whether these reflect the values that we want to live by? When was the last time we looked at our job and said, is this job forming me or am I forming it? Now, it's really easy, again, and we've talked about this throughout the series, to just kind of be distant then and go, okay, right, I'm going to go and get a new job. But if you've decided to live in a way that your behavior forms your identity, a new job isn't going to change that. Rather, it seems that Jesus' advice in the verse is actually quite practical and helpful for us. Because when we ask, well, what should I do with my time? That becomes a really stressful question. I don't know if you've ever noticed how stressful that kind of question can be had. I find myself in my younger life doing a lot of youth ministry and working with young people, constantly asking the question, well, what am I supposed to do with my life? And we want to kind of add these really clever spiritual answers to all of these sort of questions. But I think Jesus keeps it quite simple and clear for us when he says, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So the question isn't so much, you know, what am I supposed to do with myself? It seems to be more for Jesus a question of, are you happy with the behavior that you are expressing? Because if identity is greater than behavior, then are you happy that what you think you are is coming out in what you do? And if you're not, it seems that the problem then is that our barn, our storehouse, our treasure is in the wrong place. If we actually reflect on what Jesus is saying in Luke chapter 12, there's a kind of easy solution to it at one level, that most of our problems in terms of our own sense of being might come because we're investing in the wrong things. We're putting our time in the wrong places. We're investing our ideas, our energy, our pursuit of finance, our pursuit of happiness, our pursuit of status, whatever it is. We're investing it in the wrong places. And then when we invest it in the wrong places, guess what happens? Our heart, our identity gets affected by that. So Jesus asks a different question in Mark's gospel in chapter 8. He says, this is I've quoted from the King James this morning because I think this is a version that many of us have heard this phrase from before. What shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Interestingly, the word that we translate soul here, the King James sort of brought this phrase into English this way and translates it soul. But the word that Jesus uses there that we translate soul is the word psuche. So what shall it profit a person if they gain the whole world and lose their life? You can have all of this profit. I think interesting that Jesus uses economic language to describe it. But what are you investing in? What is all the sort of stuff that you want to have? And that can be status, that can be identity, that can be the title that goes in the bottom of a business card, that can be the amount of money in a bank, it can be the amount of property, or all the place that you live, the things that you do, what your kids are up to. We can kind of amass all of that sort of stuff together. And then Jesus, kind of harking back perhaps to what goes on into the parable, says, but what if it costs you your life? And life is more than just an abundance of things. It seems like Jesus is encouraging us to sort of reprogram ourselves a little bit. That is your identity found in all of those things? Is who you are made up of what you do? Or is it like the Bible wants to push us towards, is it the sense that actually who you are comes before what you do? Maybe the question that I find myself reflecting on is this: can you find purpose while looking for profit? If we've decided that, you know, what shall it profit a person, Jesus asks, what shall it profit a person to gain the whole world but lose their life? If we find ourselves in a place where profit is our driving thing, and again, let's try and think of profit beyond just simply a number that goes in a bank balance. But if it's about my status, or if it's about my perceptions of security, or where I store everything up, Jesus is asking, like, if that's your pursuit in life, what's actually happening to your life in that process? And is it possible that while you're trying to pursue the gaining of everything, it might be impossible to also figure out where your heart is? So do we need to sort of step back a little bit? Do we need to sort of move away from things? James Smith, the Canadian philosopher, would ask, do we need to rehabituate our lives? Or perhaps we ask this question, as it is the beginning of Lent this week, do we need to move from binging to fasting? Or binging says, I uncritically consume whatever comes my way, and my life starts to just kind of mirror and echo everybody else's. What do you live for? Building barns and putting things in them. And we can build all sorts of metaphorical barns in our life. We can pick all sorts of places that we think, well, this is where I'm storing everything up because this is how I want my life to be. And I suppose the question is, and the thing that needs a little bit of thought for all of us on a pretty regular basis, I think, is does my behavior match up with the identity that I would like to have? You know, if I was to write down all of the things that I wanted to stand for, all of my values and my ideologies, and if I was then to ask one of my friends to watch my life for a week and write down their list of what they think my ideologies are and my values are, would their list be anything close to my list? Because see, Jesus seems to be saying that wherever we store things, however we behave, that will fundamentally start to affect our heart and our identity. So fascinatingly, here we are as a church and we head in towards Lent this week. We start with Ash Wednesday on Wednesday, in a brilliant piece of titling, and in a world of Netflix and 15 seconds to go, and are you still watching? And have you thought about watching this next? The church comes along and says, "Hey, let's have a month, and let's stop some things. Let's fast some things." When was the last time you ever fasted anything? See, because fasting's a fascinating process, because if done correctly, you fast things that are habitual to you. You fast things that are not normal for you to live without. And maybe it's certain types of food, maybe it's certain categories of entertainment, maybe it's things that you do with your free time. You know, very few people fast going to work because their bosses make that permanent. And but something that you can do all the time that you then don't do, it sort of, it distresses you a little bit. It disturbs you a little bit. It discombobulates you. Because I normally come home from work and I eat a candy bar, I have a beer, I have a coffee, I do what this is, and now I'm not doing this. The pastor in me wants to say, well, what are you then going to do with that time? Because two things happen. There's the disruption of not doing what you ordinarily do, and that then creates in you the space and time to say, well, what might I do instead? And in a culture of binge, I think one of the things that we should do with our time on the lead up to Easter is simply ask this question, is my identity matching up with my behavior? Because the slight little bit of disruption in your life, it doesn't take much disruption. It might just be giving up that coffee. It might just be stepping away from that glass of wine. It might be a whole host of little things that you normally do, and now for 40 days you don't do them. And in the process of not doing them, it gives you a chance just to think about your behavior and your identity. And is your behavior forming your identity, or is your identity forming your behavior? Jesus said, where your treasure is, there is your heart. And I suppose another way of him asking that question would be to simply ask, is your heart where you want it to be? In your workplace, in your rest life, in your leisure life, are you actually working out the things you want to work out? Are you reflecting the type of culture and values that you want to reflect? Or, as is so unbelievably easy to do, in our culture of binge, have we just found ourselves being formed just like everybody else? So may you this week, may you at the beginning of a period of fasting, at the beginning of a journey towards Easter, the beginning of all the freedom that that brings, may you just find space in these next few days and weeks to think about who you are, to think about how you're behaving, and ask whether your heart is putting things in the right storehouses, the storehouses that you want to be placing them in. And may God's grace and peace be with you.